Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Welcome back to part two, everyone. We're here at the Moon Underwater. Everyone's dreams come true in pub form. I am the landlord. Robin Allender, the lovely Robin, is my bar swain, my beloved regular. And today we're delighted to be joined by beer writer, beer copywriter, and beer journalist, beer expert, beer taster, Pete Brown, and we're creating Pete Brown's Dream Pub, in which so far we have Tim Taylor's Landlord, Sam Alsop's IPA on draft, Tom Oliver's Perry, bottle conditioned, Cloudy Bay Sauvignon Blanc in bottles. But we're in the middle of the pub quiz, and Robin has given us three London landmark questions. So Robin, let us stick our pins in the map and find out what the answers were.
Thanks, John. So question one was, we all know that Big Ben is the name of the bell, but what is the name of the tower in which Big Ben doth reside? Pete, what are you saying for this one? Do you know?
This is the one I'm least certain about. It's a saint something. I'm going to go, it's not this, but I'm going to go with St. David's Tower or St. George's Tower or something like that.
Okay. John, what are you saying?
Is it the Elizabeth Tower?
Absolutely bang right, yeah. It was formerly just known as the Clock Tower, but it was renamed the Elizabeth Tower in 2012 to mark the Queen's Diamond Jubilee. So there we go. Very well done.
If I was the Queen, I would think, so fair enough, guys. You've renamed it after me, but for goodness sake, give me the bell.
Give me the bell.
If you're going to give me something, give me the bell.
Big Bertha.
Big Bertha's a good shout, Pete.
Yeah. Question two, this is a good one. How is the building at 30 St. Mary Axe better known? So, Pete, do you know this one?
I might not have the right... Is it the Gherkin?
Pete's saying the Gherkin. John, what have you got down?
I don't know. I wrote Buckingham Palace.
It is the Gherkin. So well done, Pete. This is a kind of interesting... So it was formerly known as the Swiss Ray Building, but now is known as its address, which is 30 St. Mary Axe. And that, obviously, it's known informally as the Gherkin, the great big skyscraper. But interesting, I thought that was such an interesting street name, the St. Mary Axe. That's the name of the street. And it's thought to derive from the combination of a church dedicated to the Virgin Mary and a neighbouring tavern, which prominently displayed a sign of the image of an axe. So it all comes back to pubs. And I looked at Google Maps.
Oh, lovely.
I looked at Google Maps and I think it's a Slug and Lettuce now. So that would be quite a...
Oh,
maybe
God.
Give
oh,
it a God. Different name. St. Mary Slug and Lettuce. Anyway, question three was monument. What is the monument a monument to? Let's go with John first.
It's our old friend, the GF of L, the Great Fire of London.
Pete, did you get that
one? Yeah, supposedly where it started, isn't it?
Yes, and it was designed by Christopher Wren. Didn't know that, but there we go. But very well done
I
if you got that.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, it is, yes. So very well done if you got those at home. And here endeth the quiz.
Well done, Robin. Another classic Moon Underwater pub quiz. And a quiz in tribute to Pete's wonderful book about the George. Is that right, Pete?
Yeah, the George in Southwark, which is used to be part of a long line of coaching inns, and it's the only one that's left. And the infuriating thing about writing about it is its immediate neighbours were two of the most famous pubs in the world.
Right, the Tabard. The Tabard was the...
The Tabard, to its right, was where Chaucer began Canterbury Tales. And then the White Hart, to its left, was where Dickens set a lot of Pickwick Papers, and also features in Henry II by Shakespeare. And the George didn't really feature anywhere, but that's the one that's left. So that's the one to write about.
Well, it did feature in a discussion we had under the sort of subheading The Thickness of Crowds, because we went there just before Christmas, and the bar itself is actually pretty small, but it's got these big, big old rooms either side, which make you feel like you're in a Christmas carol or something, and yet everyone is rammed into the bar, standing there drinking, getting in everyone's way. And there's these all these tables free. You think, what is wrong with you? But yeah,
it's such a weird layout, isn't it? It's and all these rooms just used to be used for so many different things. They used to have different bars for the coachmen and for the passengers and things like that. So the old my favourite bit is the first room, as you walk down the yard, which was the old. That's where the coachmen used to sit, and that's kind of the most unchanged bit of it, I think.
So, Pete, when you, speaking of, you know, these hallowed ancient pubs, when you imagine your dream pub, what are you thinking?
It's definitely old. I know The Moon Underwater intimately, the piece of writing that's why we're all here, that Orwell wrote, and he talks about the solid, comfortable ugliness of the 19th century.
Oh,
which is
yes.
Just like, oh, yes. And it's the stuff that was garish when it was built, but to us, you know, for the last 100 years has been traditional and old-fashioned and quaint. So I'm definitely in the comfortable old boozer that feels time-worn, that's got seats that have been moulded by countless bums and things like that.
So are you talking old as in 17th century old, or are you talking 1920s old?
If I can have whatever I want, then I'm going to go 17th century, yeah. As old as we can. Stone flag floors, ancient bar, wood, bits of wood that, you know, ceiling, I forgot what they're called, beams. Roof beams. That are reputed to have come from HMS Victory and things like that, you know.
Yeah, lovely stuff. So we now move on to your spirits. What sort of role do spirits play in your life? Because for me, as someone who really likes their beer and cider, I've had to sort of live a spiritless life, because otherwise it would just be sort of too many units coming on board.
It is something that I have to be very wary about, because it is very easy to just go over any kind of limit, really. But my taste in spirits, I went to university in St Andrews in Scotland, and there was a pub there called the Niblick, which is not there anymore.
But it was kind of like, I know what that means, Pete. It's an old term for an old type of golf club, because I love golf and I'd love to have gone to university in St Andrews.
And the Niblick was just across the road from the Royal and Ancient Golf Club, so it was often referred to as the 19th hole. And everybody from my old residence used to go drinking there. And after about 6 weeks, I went in and Tony Marini, the barman, kind of looked as I came through the door and said, "Hi, Pete, the usual." And it's like, I'm a regular.
Yeah,
I'm a regular. Yeah. Having a pint of the usual. The barman knows my name. And I think 3 weeks later I was working there, and I worked there throughout my entire career, my entire degree. And we had, the Niblick had 100 different malt whiskies on the back wall, because it was Scotland and because we got tourists and things like that. And so 100 whiskies in alphabetical order. And every now and again, someone would come in and see how far through the alphabet they could get, and no one ever got further than D. But with 100 whiskies, people come and say, "Where do I start?" And there were like two that you'd ask people what they like, not pay any attention to what they were saying, then go, "I think you'd like the Balvenie." and they did like the Balvenie, because it was approachable, it was a lowland whiskey, none of the harsh peatiness of the Islay whiskies. And people go, "I do like the Balvenie. God, you really know your whiskey, don't you?" And it's like, no, but I know Balvenie, and I know a Mark when I see one. You know? But it was, yeah, so a Balvenie double wood. is my first bottle, because it's the whiskey that I used to serve to tourists, and it's actually a really nice whiskey.
So what's your second choice?
But my second choice, I'm afraid, is another single malt. I was thinking, you know, I could have chosen a gin or something like that, because there's lots of great gins around now, but this is my pub and it's what I want and that's all that matters. So I've got to go for Laphroaig as well, because when the Balvenie is a crowd pleaser, the Laphroaig is my it's the music I play when no one else is in the room and we don't have guests. You know, it's like I'm going to put my loud stuff on now with all the feedback, and that's what the Laphroaig is.
I mean, they tried to kind of rebrand it, but the marketing around Laphroaig is quite interesting. And you with the marketing background, they tried to kind of sell it on its quirkiness, and it's the kind of one whiskey that is like you either love it or you hate it. You know, it's so smoky, isn't it? So peaty. I love it myself, but some people really, it's not for them.
It is a love hate thing. Some people either get its TCP, you know, which to be fair, I wouldn't want to drink TCP. But
it's interesting because a lot of people have chosen Laphroaig for their dream pub, but I'm just assuming, because I assume the world of single malts is about obscurity and you know, finding this tiny little cask distillery or whatever, but Laphroaig is quite a mainstream single malt. So are there other single malts with similar flavour profile that you prefer, or do you always go for a Laphroaig?
Yeah, I always kind of explore the obscure, but I do tend to come back. I think some things are mainstream for a reason.
I just don't understand how they can make so many bottles of it and yet still be a sort of, I guess, a smallish operation. I never really quite... Because there must be at any one time millions and millions of bottles of Laphroaig in the world. So how do they put it out so consistently?
When we had Emma Inch on and she chose that bourbon whiskey Maker's Mark, and every single one of those bottles is handmade with the wax seal. You know, it's got the famous wax dripping down. So yeah, it's mad that that is like an international business, but every single bottle has that handmade process going into it.
Yeah, and I think it's also probably a bit scarcer than we think. I mean, we see it in every supermarket here, but you know, if you go to the States and you find it on a menu in a bar, you're probably going to be quite excited by it.
Right. So it's perhaps not as ubiquitous as we think.
No. You get this as you go around places. I remember doing some focus groups for Everard's in Leicester, and Everard's big brand is Tiger. And you know, these guys are going, well, I only drink the really big mainstream national beers like Stella and Heineken and Tiger. And it's like you go outside Leicester and you can't find it anywhere. So I think there's a bit of that.
So two superb choices there, Balvenie Doublewood and Laphroaig. But we head over now to increase our mental capacity at the pub library.
Oh, that's interesting.
Mm. Oh, thanks, John. And, well, because he's our guest, of course, we've got Pete Brown's book, Hops and Glory, which I've already quoted from today. But at the introduction to the book, the idea came to you that we've already discussed, of your epic voyage with a barrel of IPA, came to you in a pub that John and I know very well, which is the Duke of Argyle in Soho. John and I have spent quite a few nights there, particularly during the time when they had the very strong, what was the beer called? We used to call it magic beer.
Oh, Eyingabrow Pils.
Eyingabrow Pils, that was absolute rocket fuel. I remember our friend Sam met us there one early evening, and he said he came in and it looked like our faces had melted because we'd had... Do you know when your face just starts drooping after you've had too many pints? Anyway, dreadful. But great pub. And is it still there? Because last time I walked past it, it was being refurbished, I think. Do you know if it's still there, Pete?
I think it is. It's a while since I've been to Soho, but I think it is.
The weird thing is that since I moved to London, I've not been there, but every time we visited London, we would always... go there.
A beeline, yeah. But this is Pete's little bit about the Duke of Argyle. The Argyle is a Sam Smith's pub. Chris and I love the fact that Sam Smith pubs are cultish in both commonly used senses of the word. They look like they haven't been decorated since the 1970s, but not in a bad way. They only stock their own brands of everything. They don't advertise. They don't talk to writers or journalists, even those who love them. They don't even have a website. I don't know if that's still true. Maybe it's. They're a bit funny about allowing brewery tours. If Willy Wonka had been into beer instead of chocolate, he would have been called Samuel Smith. The Argyle cashes in some of the otherworldliness all Sam Smith pubs share and buys a little normality with the proceeds, which allows it to integrate into normal society and pass itself off as a normal pub to the less observant Soho toper. And it was busy with people who looked entirely normal, footnote, normal by Soho standards, that is. So that's a great, I really like that description. Yeah, it's great. And are you still a fan of Sam Smith's pubs?
I'm a fan of the pubs, but not the owner of the business.
Mm.
Oh.
We probably shouldn't get into that in any detail on air because he's extraordinarily litigious. But I'm boycotting their pubs until he's not in the business anymore. I think I can safely say that.
Ooh. I'm now going to have to look this up in my mind. I will continue my boycott of Sam Smith's pubs, which was initially because I didn't really like the beer, but that's awful, and that doesn't fit in with any of the ethoses displayed in The Moon Underwater, where all comers are welcome, and a welcome to all comers. Pete, you described Laphroaig as the music you play when no one else is in the room. But what is the music you play when you're in the room? It's time for the pub jukebox. The Moon Underwater has a jukebox. It's got the dream pub album of every guest we've had. So what are you going to add to it?
I bet it's there already, but I'm going to add The Seldom Seen Kid by Elbow.
Mm. That is not there already.
Ah.
We have had Elbow, though. Someone has chosen Elbow.
But not The Seldom Seen Kid. I think it was quite recently we had Elbow.
Let me have a look up on my mind, on the spreadsheet of my mind, which has the Moon Underwater stats. Here we go. Builder Rocket Boys was chosen by Jan Ravens.
Ah.
Yeah.
So tell us about The Seldom Seen Kid and why Elbow is your dream pub soundtrack.
So it could have been any of their albums, but I've been lucky enough to interview the band a couple of times because they brought out a couple of beers, one for Builder Rocket Boys. And Guy Garvey basically is a consummate pub man. He spends most of his time in pubs. The band met in a pub. They played their first gigs in pubs. And a lot of the songs are kind of based on the sentimentality of pub-based friendship, really. And there's a lot of songs on there that just... They're the kind of songs that you could sing along to in a pub. They're kind of simple, beer-fueled emotion. Which is what I love about them. There's one track which is not on there. It's on a more recent album called Sad Captains, which is probably the best Elbow pub song, where it talks about generations before us sat in these seats and banged their empty cups on the table. And the chorus line is, "If we only pass this way but once, what a perfect waste of time."
Oh, yes.
And that's just the pub for me. You know, that's it. It's that easygoing. You know, when you're at the bar, you might strike up a chat with someone and end up standing there talking for an hour, or you might not. You might just go back to your table and read a book. But he captures the atmosphere and the space of a pub in lyrical form better than any other musician I know, really.
Yeah, that's brilliant. There was a thing, I think Gwendolyn Riley, a writer who we featured in the pub library, who writes brilliantly about Manchester. She says at one point that this was back in the day, if you walked around enough pubs in Manchester, you'd see either Marquis Smith or Alex Higgins. I think the same might be true of Guy Garvey now, do you think?
that's it. And people know which pubs he drinks in. And I did ask him, I said, "Is it a bit weird? You know, you're in your local and people just come in." And he said, "The first time they come in, they go, 'Oh God, it's Guy Garvey, I'm in the pub with Guy Garvey.' And then he said, 'But when I'm there the third or the fourth time, they just go, all right, guy,' and that's it. You just become part of the thing."
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hello, I'm Dave Berry, and I am fascinated by my next-door neighbour. His name is Neil Srinivasan, and he's a leading cardiologist. Since I moved to this particular part of London, Neil and I have started to become friends. Our polite greetings over the fence turned into garden barbecues and drinks down the local pub. But with unfettered access to someone with a job that is so far removed from my own, I'm desperate to find out more about his industry, one that is quite literally a matter of life and death. In Doctor Next Door, I'll be doing my utmost to learn all about Neil as a medical professional, but also Neil as a person, because, believe it or not, even doctors have lives outside of the operating theatre. But this podcast isn't just here to feed my own curiosities. I want you to be involved in these conversations too. I can't wait to get into this, so make sure you subscribe or follow Doctor Next Door from wherever you usually get your podcasts.
Now, Pete, your choices thus far are Tim Taylor's Landlord and Samuel Allsop's IPA on draft, Tom Oliver's Perry, bottle conditioned, and Cloudy Bay Sauvignon Blanc in bottles. You've got Balvenie Doublewood and Laphroaig as your spirits, but you do have one remaining choice, and this can be absolutely anything you like. So what are you going for?
Right, well, I think you mentioned a couple of times my choices might sound like they're surprisingly mainstream, given what I do for a living. So I'm going total obscure here. I'm going for some Quebecois ice cider.
Oh, wow. So I've had Quebecois ice wine, and correct me if I'm wrong, but ice wine is where they allow the grapes to freeze and thaw repeatedly. And that almost has the same effect as like sort of drying them. It concentrates the flavour somewhat. And it was one of the most beautiful things I've ever tasted. Is the same true of ice cider?
That is totally the inspiration for ice cider. And the lovely thing about apples, you know, there are so many different apple varieties, and our apple varieties grow wild. You know, if you plant a seed from an apple, you're not going to get an apple like the one that you got the seed from. You're going to get a different apple. And so when people have kind of thrown apple cores out of car windows and things like that, and you get trees sprouting up all over the place. So in Quebec, they've got these random apples that no one's identified. And they noticed that some apples stayed on the branch through the winter. And the reason it's both wine and cider in Quebec is that the average temperature at this time of year is about minus 15. So, yeah, the water in the fruit freezes and it kind of explodes out. And it leaves you this very, very concentrated syrupy juice when you then press the apples. They then age it for 8 months and you get this, basically, it is like, I mean, when you call it ice cider, a lot of people can't get their heads around what it is, which is why some producers call it apple wine. Apple dessert wine. It's not wine, it's cider, but it's the same principle. And it'll be about 10 to 12% ABV. It costs you about £30 for a 330ml bottle because that's how expensive it is to make. And when I wrote about it in my book, World's Best Cider, I said, it's like drinking Starlight. when you drink it cold, it is just the most incredible flavour. So you get that concentrated sweetness that you expect from a dessert wine, but you also get concentrated acidity to balance that sweetness. And so it's kind of perfectly balanced, sticky, liqueur-like thing. And I have a bottle every now and again, and when I introduce it to people, I remember my friend Dusty came round once, and I got one bottle out, and we had it between four of us, and she said, "Have you got any more?" And I said, "No, that was it." And she's like, "Liar, I know you've got more. Where is it? Come out." And of course I did have more, but like, no one's getting more than one bottle, because it's so rare. People have tried to introduce it into the UK a few times, but it's so, as I've just shown, it's quite difficult to explain what it is and why it's worth all that money. So you don't see it in very many places at all. But
what led you to discover it? Were you in Canada?
Yeah, so I was in Canada doing some beer stuff, and me and my friend Bill Bradshaw, we wrote World's Best Cider, which is the first ever kind of world encyclopedia of cider. And we had one page allocated for Canada, because we knew they made a bit of cider. And I was there on this beer trip, and I said, I'll just go to Montreal for the day. And
sorry, just to interrupt, the word's beer trip. Oh, God, I wish I had more wish I had more beer trips in my life. Oh, God, brilliant. Sorry to interrupt.
But I went to Montreal, and these guys put this little tour of cideries together for me. And I was after the first day, I was on the phone to Bill saying, "You know, I've got a page for Canada. We need five pages. We're going to have to cut something else, because I've found this is like, I've just hit a mother load. There's nothing like it anywhere else in the world. It's one of the nicest drinks I've ever had. People don't know about it. We're the first to cover it." And just the imagery of these apples sitting on the branch with kind of frozen, you know, icicles underneath the apples from the water that's erupted out of them. And it's just, you can't separate the product from the imagery. It's just, it's like, it's what, you know, it's what they drink in Narnia, probably.
As a cider connoisseur, a cider expert, does your heart sink when you walk into a pub and see the ciders they have available, which are often flavoured crappy ciders from the other side of the world, even if they're made over here? And do you think cider will have a similar revolution to sort of craft beer, in that we may go, "God, could you remember when we used to drink Blackberry Old Moot?" When we're just 12 miles from, you know, this orchard or that producer, because it always amazes me that we live in one of the centres of cider production in this country, and yet the actual cider we have access to in pubs, 99% of the time, is absolute crap.
Yeah, it is a travesty. Part of it is also the curse of my job, because before I wrote World's Best Cider, I was perfectly happy with a bottle of Magnus over ice. And then you go and you get your palate educated, and you come back to that bottle and you go, "Oh, it's rubbish now. why did I have to go and learn all that stuff?" But yeah, I mean, I wrote a book called The Apple Orchard, which was weirdly patriotic. And I'm not a jingoistic, nationalistic, Brexit-type person at all. But the simple truth of the matter is that we've got the best apple-growing terroir in the world. And apples that originated in New Zealand, if you plant them here, they'll grow better than they did in New Zealand. And it's not something many of us know. It's not something we're proud of. I go to my local grocers, and they've got Pink Ladies from New Zealand, and they've got Granny Smiths from Spain. And it's like, but we've got better apples in Kent, just down the road. And so it's incredibly frustrating. And a well-made cider is as good as a well-made wine or champagne. And part of it is the producers. I always say, if you get two cider makers in a room, you'll have three sets of opinions. They won't talk to each other. They don't hang out. They don't like each other. A lot of them are perfectly happy being small scale and just kind of producing for, you know, the demand that they get. But the good thing about that is that when you do go and discover it, there is that genuine sense of discovery. I think we've got used to expecting everything good just to be on our doorsteps. And if you want the best cider, you've got to go and work for it. You've got to go and find it. And there is still, I'd rather it was in my local pub, on balance, but there is a satisfaction to get to a farm in Somerset and tasting something straight from the barrel and going, "Wow, this is brilliant," and having to take a tub of it home in one of those plastic cartons, because that's the only way you can get it home.
So in the way that, say, even my local pub, which is, you know, 400 years old, well, there's loads of them, and they're all that old, I would walk in, and there'll be, you know, two mainstream lagers, but there'll probably be a craft lager and a craft pale ale. Do you think we might get to the stage where a pub will have one unusual cider or one box of cider that's from a local cider maker, or do you think that they're not really the sorts of producers who want that?
I think another aspect of it is that there's an image dimension. I talked about this in my book on craft, but a lot of us kind of say that we like craft beer for its quality and its flavour and stuff like that. It also happens to be really cool and design-led, which no one will admit to. But there is craft cider everywhere. It's just that it's on farms and it comes in plastic tubs and it's not very cool and the labels are hand-drawn.
It's not got skulls all over it.
Exactly. I think one thing that might change... The only thing that might change it is legislation. I think a lot of people aren't aware that those ciders you're talking about are less than 50% apple juice and the rest of it is water and additives and caramel and colouring. Imagine finding out that your favourite bottle of wine was only 35% grape juice and the rest of it was, you know, it's just outrageous. And there is a campaign for raising the legal requirement to at least 50% juice. Because it's not a guarantee that the more juice content you have, the better the cider will be. But every good cider I've ever tasted has got high juice content.
So what would be the juice content of a cider that you would get from a farm in a bottle that you'd take home yourself?
100% juice.
Right.
Maybe with a little bit of added sugar or maybe watered down a tiny bit, depending on the harvest and the strength of the apples in that particular season. But when it's 100% juice, they'll put it on the bottle and tell you that it's 100% juice. When it's not 100% juice, they are evasive about it. And the lower the juice content, the more evasive they are about telling you.
Very good. Well, fingers crossed that day will come soon.
Your bard.
We now move on to what you would like to bar from your pub. Now, we had a brief discussion that was redacted due to potential threat of litigation. But if you were in charge of what was and wasn't allowed in your pub, what would you ban?
I'm going to be grumpy about this and... I was going to name another individual, but I won't go down that route.
I think I know who you mean.
there's a connection to the moon underwater, put it that way. But no, I think it'd be smartphones, you know. I did read about a pub that installed a Faraday cage that meant that smartphones wouldn't work inside the pub, which I think is such a brilliant idea. Because I'm as bad as anybody else. I'm not slagging off. I'm not saying the young people on their phones. I'm not, because I'm just as bad as anybody else is. But you get your phone out and then suddenly there's four of you sitting around a table all staring at your screens. And it's just, I think the most important point about a pub is being present in it and enjoying the time while you're there. And sometimes we'll go to the pub and leave our phones at home, and it's a wrench, but you always enjoy it more when you do.
Yeah. I think that's definitely a good one for if there's a group of people. I think, as John, you were saying, you were doing a gig and you were backstage, a load of other comics, and everyone was on their phone. And another comedian, the compere, walked in and goes, "It's the banter I love."
Yeah.
It's just so good. But I love that. So I definitely think there's a case for if there's a big group of you, no phones. But I do think if you're on your own, a phone can be like having a book with you, or, you know, you might be, you know, as long as you're not like aimlessly scrolling, you know.
Well, I think even if you're aimlessly scrolling, I mean, I sort of agree with you about groups, but then an awful lot of pub discussion can be, oh, did you see that photo of X, or would you like to see my kids? Or, and it does have a place. And I think when I'm on my own, I tend not to be a big sort of social media junkie in the day. But if I go to the pub on my own for a pint or two, that might be the time when I sort of catch up on Twitter or big text conversations or WhatsApp groups that have got out of control and I just can't face during the day. So it can be quite a nice quiet moment on your own, but I think you're right in that often I think one of the most depressing things you can see in a pub is a couple or a date where they are just sat scrolling, and especially if it's like two parents with their kids running around and they're just sat on their phones and you think, why are you here?
Yeah, exactly. And my favourite regular pub moment is most days I try and take the dog for a walk around the park. And then at this time of year, you've got to be quite mindful of how soon it's getting dark. And usually finishing the walk just as it's starting to fall dark, going to the pub with a book and having two pints on my own reading my book. And sometimes I do that And I've finished my second pint and I haven't opened the book yet because I've been looking at Twitter. And it's just like, oh, and I always feel like that's a wasted occasion.
Or you're kind of arranging the book on the table next to the pint and taking a photo on your phone, posting it on Twitter. Yeah, yeah.
Okay, well, what a pub you have created, Pete. And what a delight it has been to chat to you. Before we get on to the naming of the pub, the sacred naming, if you could only visit one pub in the other realm for the rest of your life, even though you've now got your dream pub to take with you, what pub would it be? What pub ticks most of your boxes?
There's one pub I know which, if you go back to Orwell's description in The Moon Underwater, and he names 10 different criteria, and he says, but in the real world, no pub has them all. You know, the pub that's got the really good beer garden has got crap beer, and the pub that's got the best beer doesn't have any atmosphere, and that all that kind of stuff. And I believe there's one pub which would tick all 10 of Orwell's boxes, and it's the Cooper's Tavern in Burton-on-Trent.
Ooh. And does it even have China tankards?
Well, I'm taking liberties here and saying when he talks about China tankards, he's talking about the right kind of glassware for the drink.
Okay, yeah, yeah, I accept that.
Yeah, when he's talking about liver sandwiches, he's talking about the best bar snacks.
Yeah.
So with a degree of interpretation and modernisation, the only thing is because it's in the Midlands, they do tend to say ducky, which he banned, so...
Is the Cooper's Arms, is it that kind of old Victoriana kind of pub as well? Does it look like...
It's really quite plain. It's like a house. It's like a big house. It looks like a house from the outside, apart from the pub sign. But it's got kind of a parlour. It's really eccentric because it's got a full bar, which faces onto a brick wall because it's been built down a passageway. So you have to stand at the corner of the bar and look down the bar. You can only get served at this little corner at the hatch where the staff get in. And then around that, there's some raised seats. And even if you've never been there before and you don't know anything about Burton's brewing heritage, you just know that you have to be invited to sit in these special seats. It's like in medieval churches where they had the seats for the rich families that nobody else was allowed to sit in. And these are the seats that you can only sit in if you're a Burton brewer, if you're a brewmaster. And so you get these old guys in there sometimes and you just kind of reverentially go into the other room and stuff.
Do you know what? I'm looking it up in my mind, Pete, and it is almost exactly what I imagine Orwell to be thinking about. It is like a sort of 1930s detached sort of three-bed house or whatever. But in the bar, they've got 1, 2, 3, 4 cask. They've got, behind that, they've got 6 barrels, actually kegs. No, not kegs, 6 casks.
Yeah, just on stillage behind the bar, yeah.
Yeah, it looks absolutely superb.
Oh, we've got to pay this a visit. It looks amazing.
We've got to pay this a viz.
Hurry up, please. It's time.
Oh, what a lovely, lovely pub. The Cooper's Tavern in Burton-on-Trent. Well, it's a great name. It's a common name. But what's the name of your pub going to be, Pete?
I struggled with this. I think on a show like this, you want to come up with a funny name that's going to get a laugh. And I've just been watching Meet the Richardsons, and I love the fact that he's got a pub in his back garden called The Dog and Bastard. And
I've been to The Dog and Bastard.
Have you?
Yeah.
I mean, it's tempting to come up with something like that. But if it was my pub and I was drinking in it, I wouldn't want it to have a funny name, actually. So I've actually gone really boring, and it'd be called something like... If it's going to represent what I want from the pub, it's going to be called something like The Welcome Inn or The Welcome Home.
Oh, lovely. The Welcome Inn. Love that. Love that. Well, we're about to bid you farewell, Pete, and it's been such a pleasure to chat to you. But you do have one last choice to make, and that's the music that you want to play you out as you make that trip into the other realm. So what track from The Seldom Seen Kid would you like to play you out?
I guess it would have to be the one that everyone knows. We'll go with, I forgot what it's called.
We can all hum it. We all know the one. Bum, 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 bum.
Throw those curtains wide. One day like this.
There we go.
So It's going to have to be the one that everyone knows, which is One Day Like This, which is the massive sing-along that 10 years ago you couldn't turn on a charity telethon or an inspirational financial services ad or anything else without hearing it.
Even MasterChef, you know.
I'm sure that song paid for quite a few pints in their local. We used to play it on Radio X and I'd go for a wee. So I get to hear it again. So to play out Pete Brown, celebrated beer writer from The Moon Underwater, we have One Day Like This by Elbow. Bye-bye.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.